Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Halverson, Judge Connolly, and Judge Slater. The Honorable Jill Flaskin Paul first presiding.
Come on in. Please be seated. On behalf of the panel, welcome to the Court of Appeals this ninth day of April, 2019. Marshall, could you please call our first case for oral argument?
Calling consolidated cases A18-1256 and A18-1398. Kenneth Lloyd Morris, individually and derivatively on behalf of Rural Energy Solutions, LLC, appellants, plaintiffs, David Jones et al., appellants, versus Michael Lee Swan et al., respondents.
Thank you. It's my understanding appellants would like to divide the time 12 minutes and 3. Is that correct? Okay, so I've asked the marshal to reflect that on the clock, just so you don't, whoever argues first doesn't have to be mindful of the 12-minute time running. You all know our rules. Please note your appearance as you commit your argument in chief. Counsel for appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kaynard Hunt, and I represent the appellants, Kenneth Morris, individually, and on behalf of Rural Energy Solutions, referred to as RES. Appellants seek reinstatement of the lawsuit, and appellant Morris also seeks reversal of the attorney fee award against him. This action was dismissed pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 12.03, judgment on the pleadings, Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 1901, failure to join a necessary party, and Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 8.01, the complaint was not short and plain. I will address all of these grounds in that order. Starting with the Rule 12 dismissal, a Rule 12.03 motion for judgment on the pleadings resembles a Rule 12.03 motion seeking dismissal for failure to state a claim. To withstand a motion, the plaintiff must state facts, if proven, that would provide a colorable claim in support of relief. All benefit of the doubt is given to the plaintiff in such a motion. Applying that standard to the complaint here, the complaint meets that standard, and this action must be reinstated. The LLC at issue is governed by Minnesota Statute Chapter 322B. MnSTAT Section 322B.606 requires that certain actions on behalf of an LLC be undertaken and approved either by the Board of Governors or unanimous vote of the members. Under MnSTAT Section 322B.40 Subdivision 3, only a Board of Governors has authority to accept and value new contributions to the LLC. Because this LLC had no Board of Governors, unanimity by the members was required for those actions of taking a capital call and valuing, which did not occur.
Ms. Nord, I can also ask this of Respondents' Counsel, but it's undisputed here there was no Board of Governors.
There was not. There is no Board of Governors, and the respondent in the district court, in response to our response, admitted that there was no Board of Governors. So that is how the case comes before the court. So what we have is a case with the respondents without member unanimity, nonetheless accepted new investments which were improperly valued. This caused a disproportionate dilution of appellant Morris' ownership interests, causing him damage, which claim is asserted in count one, pursuant to MnSTAT Section 322B.40 subdivision four. In complaint count Roman numeral 2, appellants seek to undo the capital call on the ground that the capital call was not properly authorized by the Board of Governors. Again, the lack of unanimity. And second, even if it were, it was not carried out according to the resolution adopted on June 2013 member meeting. So as stated, because there was no statutorily constituted board, you have to have a unanimity. Count two is premised on relief pursuant to MnSTAT Section 322B.22 Subdivision 2, and also for declaratory relief under MnSTAT Section 555.01. And then we go to complaint paragraph 3. There, plaintiff asserts he's entitled to equitable relief pursuant to MnSTAT Section 322B.83 Subdivision 2 II. because of unfair and prejudicial conduct toward him on the part of respondents. As alleged in the complaint, the respondents have expressed their desire to force him out after unfairly diluting his share by having failed to comply with the organizational formalities. They've acted unfairly, and they violated the duty to act in an honest and fair way as to other members.
What would equitable relief look like here?
Equitable relief here looks like that you would return to the status quo, that you would you would get rid of the contributions that were made in violation of the statute. You would restore Morris to his share. There's also an assertion that when all that's done, that the court could look at dissolving the corporation. So it is a claim for equitable relief. Turning now to the court's dismissal under Rule 19. Now, there's a difference between a required or sometimes called necessary party and an indispensable party. Rule 1901 first asks who is a required or necessary party and whether joinder is feasible. Rule 1902 then asks the question, if a required party cannot be joined, is that party an indispensable party, and in the party's absence, the case cannot proceed. The trial court says that Plan Energy Acquisition Corporation is a necessary party. If so, the result of that would not be dismissal. It would be that the court order it joined. And the Plan Energy, as the complaint alleges, is a Minnesota corporation located in Woodbury, Minnesota, so there would be no reason not to order the joinder. Respondents have essentially argued as to the necessary party piece that Plan Energy's interest is not protected or complete relief cannot be afforded without its involvement, but actually that's not true. If respondents' position in the litigation turns out to be correct, it has no exposure to Plan Energy, and Plan Energy stays as it is. If appellant's position turns out to be correct, Plan Energy is in the same position as is the those members, Swan, who contributed money in violation of the capital call, so you would have the same necessity of probably viewing it as a loan and returning the money with interest and squaring all that up, but they would be in the same position. So there really isn't a situation here where there would be a violation of 1902, but we don't really even get to the 1902 dismissal on an indispensable party basis because of the first prong of 1901 with the joinder assertion. But if the court were to go there, the trial court had to make the analysis whether in equity and good conscience the action should proceed among the parties before it, which it didn't make that analysis either. So there is no basis on this record to affirm the trial court under the 1901. Turning to Rule 8, while it's true that appellant's complaint is lengthy, it is pled with sufficient directness and clarity to provide the respondents notice of the claims against them. One can read this complaint, and you can easily determine who is being sued and for what. That is the essence of what Rule 8 requires. And the rules of civil procedure as a whole, as this court is well aware, are designed to have the case decided on the merits. If the claim was truly deficient under Rule 8, the correct result would be to order it repled, not a dismissal with prejudice under Rule 8. Finally, turning to the attorney's fees issue, if the court agrees with appellant's analysis that this case does indeed present a colorable claim, then the attorney fees all have to go as well. What the trial court ruled, it says, It is awarding fees because of the way the complaint was put together and in reliance on law plainly not applicable. Well, if the court agrees that this is not a proper Rule 12 and for all the other reasons, then the attorney fees go. In addition, Mr. Morris, as a representative party, cannot be held responsible under a Rule 11 basis for attorney's fees, and that appears to be the reasoning of the trial court. The trial court did not make any findings that square with Minnesota Statute 322B.833 Subdivision 7, which refers to arbitrary, vexatious, or not in good faith. In addition, as this court has held, in order to award attorney's fees under that provision, you have to find a breach of fiduciary duty and a finding of bad faith, none of which exists in this record. So, appellant respectfully requests that this court reverse, reinstate the case, and reverse the award of attorney's fees. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hunt.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Roger Stahl. I'm appearing on my own behalf and on behalf of my co-counsel, Mr. David Jones. We were co-counsel of the plaintiffs at the trial court level. The issue in the consolidated appeal that's our part of the case, case number 1390, concerns the imposition of sanctions, fees against myself and my co-counsel. In our brief, we've framed the question or the issues as involving Rule 11.02, subparts A through C, although in the trial court's written decision, you cannot discern that at all. However, that's how we have framed the question and for completeness sake have treated it in our brief.
Counsel, did the other side in seeking sanctions provide you notice as
yes.
they were required under the statute?
Correct. They did, yes. The trial court gave two bases for awarding fees in this matter. The first was that we were attempting to hide or hiding the lack of a lawful claim by filing voluminous documents incorporated into the pleadings, and secondly, that we were relying on law that was plainly not applicable in this matter. When we pressed the trial court on this matter at the subsequent fee hearing, the trial court narrowed its basis, or seemed to, writing that even if the extensive documents were incorporated by reference were necessary because of the complex nature of the case, there was nevertheless no colorable claim within the pleadings filed by the plaintiff. As is evident from our brief and these arguments so far, that's the fundamental question in this case, is whether there are colorable claims. And we believe it is plain that at a minimum, the claims that were asserted in the complaint were colorable. And this obviously has implications for the entire case, not the least of which the award of the attorney's fees.
Mr. Stahl, and I know you've got very limited time, but so you really are dependent, of course, on the success of Morris's claim. I mean, do you have an argument that the amount of fees was an abuse of the district court's discretion, separate and apart from the connection to the merits?
That's a fair question. And at the hearing on the fees, we took the strategy and position that fees were not warranted, period. We did not argue that in the alternative, even though we think, and it's our opinion, that the fees that were awarded were most certainly excessive. But in the end analysis, we felt the case was argued more strongly, both for purposes at the trial court level and here, that we had to focus on the fact that there were colorable claims, which is to say there were claims there based on a plain reading of the statute that could be made in good faith, and we did. And so we elected, rather than arguing in the alternative, to focus solely on the fact that fees just are not justifiable in this instance. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, Philip Gainsley for the defendants, respondents. According to Mr. Morris's complaint, defendant RES is a limited liability company formed by three members, him and my clients, Michael Swan and Mike Driscoll. Its purpose was to build and manage and operate pipeline utilities. In June 2013, the LLC concluded that it needed additional funds. Messrs. Swan and Driscoll asked Mr. Morris to join them and contribute a sum in proportion to each of their existing membership interests. Messrs. Swan and Driscoll contributed their share of the needed funds, but Mr. Morris declined, as a result of which the RES was short of funds. And pursuant to statute and by notice, RES offered to third parties the opportunity to invest at the same price as offered to the LLC's existing members.
Could you pin down the section of the statute you're referring to when you say that by authority of statute, Mr. Gainsley?
It's the statute, excuse me. B-40. Plan Energy, PAC, made the contribution that was requested from Mr. Morris, and it then became a member of RES.
At the risk of interrupting you again, do you concede there is no Board of Governors here?
No, I don't concede that.
And how was it established then?
Under the definitions statute that says that the governing body is a Board of Directors. So if you don't have an elected Board of Directors, the governing body, and in the briefs of Mr. Morris and his counsel, we are always referred to as the governing body, or frequently referred to as the governing body. And that was the purpose of the definition statute.
Mr. Gainsley, is that the same as in, you referenced 322B40 requires acts of the Board of Governors? So you're reading that definition to mean in lieu of or in replace of this becomes a Board of Governors?
That's how I read the definition statute, yeah, it's, section 23, yes.
Would you agree that in any event, this court would have to agree with that interpretation in order for that cause of action?
Well, I'm not sure how the court can't agree. I mean, 322B.
Well, apparently you haven't been here long enough.
I've had this court disagree with me in the past.
I'm sure we got it wrong then, too.
322B03, subdivision 23. I mean, it's a declarative sentence. The Board of Governors is the governing body, or the governing body is the Board of Directors. Not shall be, not might be, is. And
well, let me just ask you, because I think this is a pivotal issue in the case. Under 322B606, which is the Board of Governors section, if you have that available to you.
I do indeed.
Okay. You know, under subdivision one, of course, it seems to define three different ways to name a Board of Governors, naming them in the articles of organization, elected by the organizers or by the members or by a member control agreement. Does this particular Board of Governors in your analysis fit into one of the three?
No,
okay.
It does not. Take a look, please, at subdivision 2. Mm-hmm. It says the owners of the membership interests entitled to vote for the governors of a limited liability company may, by unanimous affirmative vote, take any action that the chapter requires or permits the board to take. The purpose of that subdivision is that if the members disagree with the board, this is inapplicable to these facts, but now that you've asked it, if the members disagree with the board and the members then take their own action instead of a board action, the members then become responsible and liable, and the board, colloquially speaking, is off the hook, is not liable. That's the purpose of subdivision 1 and subdivision 2 of point 606. Okay. After PAC made the contribution that was requested from Mr. Morris, PAC became a member of RES. And then, as you know, 3 years later, Mr. Morris commenced this action. After 115 paragraphs, complete with footnotes and encyclopedic explanations of the law, spread over 34 pages and over 300 sheets of exhibits, Mr. Morris, who boycotted at least 9 meetings and abstained from voting at others, for himself and then purportedly for RES, pleaded 3 counts, each of which the district court properly dismissed for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. At the outset, let me say that Mr. Morris makes much of the law that factual allegations in a complaint must be accepted as true. But what he ignores is the law's qualification, that he must state facts that, if proved, would support a colorable claim entitling him to relief. Here, the colorable claim is authorized by statute. That's the NSP case so often cited. Now, setting aside the procedural deficiencies, which I hope to have time to discuss later, Mr. Morris's complaint, and it took him 13 pages in his brief just to explain the complaint, this court should affirm the district court for the following reasons. I've already said that in count 1, 322B03, subdivision 23, by definition, RES's governing body, quote, is the board of directors, close quote. But setting that aside, any claim that the governors did wrong is derivative. Under 322B40, assuming but not conceding that the governor sat by and did nothing that was against the unfair, so-called unfair consideration, they're liable to the LLC for the benefit of the member who did not vote and who was damaged. Now, the statute is unambiguous. The statute says, to the LLC. It goes on to say, for the member's benefit. But clearly, the legislature and the rulemakers wanted that cause of action to be the LLC's cause of action. And that makes it a derivative action under Rule 23, with which Mr. Morris failed to comply. Recall, Mr. Morris retreated from arguing that he brought a derivative action on RES's behalf when he said, well, I just did that in claim, that the derivative claim in format or style. The district court properly concluded that he did not bring a derivative claim, but that he should have under the statute. It's not his choice whether to bring a derivative claim. It's the statute's choice. The statute tells us whether a claim is on behalf of a member or a derivative. Also, Mr. Morris's allegations were mere labels and legal conclusions. For example, the phrase, not reasonable under the circumstances, is a legal conclusion. That's not a statement of fact. I might also add that Exhibit M was a purported transcript that he refers to in his brief. It doesn't even pretend to show a foundation or a source or it's genuine. It's a fiction. And such a fiction cannot survive a motion for judgment on the pleadings, even under the most liberal construction of a complaint. A fabricated document is not given the attention of the court. The same is true with figures pulled out of thin air, or as he says in his complaint, the implied valuation. Those are hypothetical figures. That's not a statement of fact that this court gives deference to under Rule 12. Going to count 2, the relief pursuant to 322.22. This was properly dismissed for 3 alternative reasons. First, the proceeding must be by a member against the LLC. Not true here. Second, 322B22 requires an LLC member to seek an injunction against the LLC, which is not being sought by Mr. Morris's verified complaint. And third, the LLC itself must be the plaintiff, either directly or derivatively. That's not the case here either. Moreover, Mr. Morris is wrong on the law when he argues that cash calls must be by unanimous vote. Cash calls are governed by 346, 322B 346, requiring only a majority of the affirmative vote. And the only exception to majority vote is the election of governors, which must be by a plurality of cumulative votes. What we did was correct, and it was in compliance with the statute. And as I said earlier in response to Judge Connolly's question, 606, the application of 606, 322B6, is wrong. It's wrong as a matter of law. The statute provides that the management of an LLC is entrusted to the Board of Governors, but where the members take the action, then the governors are not liable to third parties. Where the members take that action, they become liable. And that's not the facts. That's not this case. Count 3 was properly dismissed because Mr. Morris has not made the required buyout motion under 833 subdivision 2. That statute is very precise about the required conditions, and Mr. Morris has pleaded none of them. No deadlock, no fraud, no treatment of him any differently from others, no division in voting power, no misapplication, no waste of assets, no failure to wind up the LLC's affairs following dissolution. Each of Mr. Morris's counts is a creature of statute. Compliance with the statute is a condition to maintaining his complaint, and he has not done so. In addition to Mr. Morris's failure to state claims under the statutes he relies upon, his complaint was woefully deficient. He failed to comply with rules governing derivative actions, although I must say he's schizophrenic about whether there should be or should not be a derivative action. And as I said a moment ago, it's the statute that determines that. It is not the plaintiff who determines that. Courts, with regard to Rule 19, courts don't act in a vacuum. If Mr. Morris had wanted to move the court for an order bringing in or joining PAC, he could have done so, but he didn't do so. Moreover, he had at least three opportunities to do so, and he did not do so. That was throughout the history of this. He would sit on his hands, do nothing while the corporation struggled to make itself successful. And that's why, frankly, Rule 12 is the remedy, not that the court should act on its own and join a party. Rule 12 is the remedy for failure to name a party. Let me take my remaining time to talk about attorney's fees, if I may. Most of Mr. Morris's arguments are raised for the first time on appeal, and this court should ignore those arguments. But in their initial motion for summary judgment, for a judgment on the pleadings, the defendants moved the court for an award of attorney fees. And Judge Duncan responded, because plaintiff attempted to hide the lack of lawful claim, hide the lack of a lawful claim.
Well, she was saying that based on the length of the complaint.
And I don't have it here, and the voluminous documents. I mean, when that process server comes and serves the length of the complaint, I mean, yes, she was. And it was unduly lengthy. Not only was it too long, but it didn't say the right things. So both in procedural and substance, the complaint was poorly drawn. Counsel has conceded that they did not object.
Mr. Gainsley, on that point, I have to admit, I understand the second part, because she seems to be implying that the complaint is does not have merit. When she says, when the district court said, and plaintiff attempted to rely on law that was plainly not applicable, so I assume that means it wasn't a merit, but I've never heard of attorney's fees being awarded because a complaint is too long. I mean, if that was the case, I think most of the attorneys in federal court would be sanctioned because their complaints are very long.
I don't think, Judge, she said it too long. She said its length was served the purpose of hiding the failure to state a claim. It wasn't that it was too long. It was that it was, her word was obfuscated. The lengthy complaint obfuscated the fact that there was no claim. You know, counsel said in one of the briefs that at first we say it's too long and then we say it's not long enough. That's not our position at all. Our position is what it says,
right,
not the length of the complaint. I need to stop.
Thank you, Mr. Gainsley. Rebuttal? I'm assuming there's no division of time for this, Ms. Hunt?
No.
Okay.
With regard to the action, the trial court denied their motion to dismiss under Rule 23 that the claims were derivative. Instead, she found they were direct, which appellant agrees with. These are all direct claims. And since respondent didn't file a notice of related appeal, cross appeal, that issue is not before the court. With regard to the complaint is detailed, and the complaint does present a colorable claim under the law. And the court asked a question about the Board of Governors. There was no Board of Governors. The statute specifically states how you establish a Board of Governors, none of which occurred in this case. So then what happens in a situation like this where you don't have a Board of Governors and where the statute 322B.40 specifically says, subject to any restrictions in the Articles of Organization or Member Control Agreement, and only when authorized by the Board of Governors or pursuant to a Member Control Agreement, a limited liability company may accept contributions under Subdivision 2 and 3. And then in Subdivision 4, it talks about valuation by the Board of Governors. Well, we have no Board of Governors. That's why you go to 606. 606 Subdivision 2 provides that the owners of the membership interest entitled to vote for governors of a limited liability company may, by unanimous affirmative vote, take any action that this chapter requires or permits the Board of Governors to take. Okay, so when you don't have a Board of Governors, then the way you do it is by unanimous vote. That's what the statute says. And that's not what occurred here.
There was Mr. Gainsley seems to argue that Subdivision 2 is really for the members' use when they disagree with an existing board.
Absolutely not. That's not what the statute says.
That's based on plain language.
Based on plain language. I mean, what it says is that the Board of Governors, you can, so let's say you have a Board of Governors. The members can bypass the Board of Governors by unanimous vote. But if you don't have a Board of Governors and the Board of Governors needs to take this action, you can only do it by unanimous vote. I mean, that's what occurs. So that's why unanimity was imperative here, which didn't occur, which leads to the what we have is a capital call that should not have occurred. We have a dilution of Mr. Morris's interest, which should not have occurred, to which he's entitled to damages because all this is a direct claim. The corporation isn't harmed in this situation. It is the member that is harmed by the dilution in his share. And recently in the In Re Medtronic case, I mean, the Minnesota Supreme Court again recognized that when you're talking in the dilution of a shareholder's share, that is a direct action. So that's why the one thing the trial court got correct was that this isn't a derivative case, that these are all direct claims.
And Ms. Nord, I assume from what you just said, you disagree then with Mr. Gainsley's point that the definitional provision he referenced, 322B03 subdivision 23, by reading that definition allows us basically the replacement of the Board of Governors wherever the Board of Governors otherwise would be in the statute.
I absolutely disagree, and it really runs counter to the statute as a whole because, I mean, the statute as a whole talks about how you get the governing board, and it is by, you know, in the Articles of Organization or by two different ways of election, none of which occurred. So when you don't have that, you just don't have governing board in the air that you can just kind of say, well, this is it. But what you can do is that the members can act in place of the board, but only with unanimity. And that's what the statute says. And that's why this, you know, this lawsuit certainly presents a colorable claim. I mean, the idea that you can dismiss a claim for equitable relief on a Rule 12, I can't find anywhere. I mean, clearly there is the cause of action for unfairly prejudicial conduct against Mr. Morris when they specifically assert they're trying to force him out of the corporation, that they have diluted his interests, and I ask that this court reverse and reinstate this action. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank all counsel for their arguments today. Matter's been submitted.